This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of June 2016. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Texas abortion providers planning for a Supreme Court ruling that could result in more clinic closures.
Every day we're like, okay, you know, is this the day where we're going to find out what's going to happen?
What a transgender middle school student thinks about the Texas bathroom debate.
I feel like it would be better if I could just use the girls' bathrooms in locker rooms.
And how you can drink a classic cocktail for charity this weekend.
It's surprisingly refreshing, even though it is bitter.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, just a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast if you want to. If you go to weekend.kut.org, you'll find links to our iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. If you haven't already, please feel free to leave us a review in the iTunes store or in the Apple Podcasts app. And if you have any questions, you can email news@kut.org. You can always reach me. I'm nathan@kut.org or on Twitter @KUTNathan. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to issue a ruling on the state's controversial abortion bill in the coming weeks. Abortion providers and activists in Texas are waiting on pins and needles to hear what the court decides. In the meantime, they're also preparing for a possible loss and the clinic closures that could result.
Because the court has only 8 justices right now, there are 3 possible outcomes in the case against the Texas abortion law known as House Bill 2. 2 of those outcomes, including a tie vote, means the law would be upheld. And for people who do the work of either providing or securing access to legal abortions here in Texas, that possibility is pretty stressful.
You know, each time I kind of write my draft for a response to a negative decision, a decision that would basically uphold HB 2, my heart just sinks, you know, and this is extremely nerve-wracking. You know, we're sort of like every day, we're like, okay, you know, what? Is this the day where we're going to find out what's going to happen?
That's Amanda Williams with the Lilith Fund and Sarah Wheat with Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas. The Lilith Fund helps low-income women pay for an abortion. Planned Parenthood operates an abortion clinic here in Austin. If HB 2 stands, that clinic would be one of 9 in the state that advocates say will stay open. Others will be forced to close. And this scenario, clinics closing overnight, is not unfamiliar to Williams or Wheat. In fact, Wheat says this reminds her of more than a year ago when the law was fully in effect and the Supreme Court hadn't announced it would hear the case yet.
You know, that was incredibly distressing and stressful because we did see so many clinics in the state have to basically close or, you know, stop providing services. And we saw what an impact that had and just how many women were having to call our clinic just, you know, frantic.
Amanda Williams says she remembers when the law was first enacted and there was a lot of fear and confusion. She and others had to figure out logistics, which clinics were still open and how to get women there on a moment's notice. Williams says that's what she thinks about as she waits for the ruling.
We don't want to live that again. That sort of frantic period was just so overwhelming. But I think what we are doing is just kind of preparing for the worst, right? We know that we've been through this before. We've come out of it. We can do this.
The Supreme Court is releasing opinions over the next couple of weeks. Justices will be weighing in specifically on 2 provisions of HB 2. One, requiring clinics to meet the standards of an ambulatory surgical center and that abortion doctors have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The Austin City Council this week voted in favor of establishing a local taxi cooperative, but this ordinance still needs one more vote to be approved, to be officially approved. Nagata Desa, a board member with the taxi co-op, asked the City Council to hurry up and approve the request to add 548 taxis to the roads.
Every driver in the city is in a cloud right now. Everything else was done to fill the vacuum created here by Uber and Lyft left, but the driver is still not comfortable on what they have right now.
Now, for a look at the proposed model of this taxi co-op, here's KUT's Audrey McGlinchey.
It was a TV show that taught me that cooperative businesses run on an equal buy-in from all members. Alana from Comedy Central's Broad City learns this the hard way when she fails to complete her shift at a local grocery co-op. The owner's not very happy.
For the privilege of membership, you just have to work 6 hours. You cooperate.
I am feeling this. But it just also happens to be the very last day I can have this procedure.
Well, either you complete your shifts today, or you're banished from the co-op for the rest of your body's life.
To learn more, I went to an actual co-op.
Hi, my name's Nicole Renault, and I work on the business team at Black Star Co-op, which is a cooperatively owned and worker self-managed brew pub in North Central Austin.
In any business, including a pub, you've got three things: your product, your workers, and your customers. In a co-op, at least one of these is given democratic control of the business. At Black Star, it's the customers. Members become part owners. With the city's new taxi co-op, things are a little different. But all cooperatives adhere to certain principles. Here's Renault again.
The cooperative values are, autonomy and independence, democratic member control, or...
There's no boss. Yeah, we're all at one equal level, and we're striving to attain economic independence.
David Passmore heads up the Taxi Driver Association of Austin and led the campaign to build a local taxi cooperative.
We just recognized that we had to do something rather than being left behind throughout the whole process, is be at the table when the discussion is happening, because that's one thing that the drivers didn't have before.
As Passmore explains it, drivers would pay a weekly member fee of roughly $130. Right now, cab drivers pay anywhere from $200 to nearly $500 a week in fees and leasing payments. But co-op drivers would not need to lease cars. They'd use their own. And they'd get 100% of their fares, as opposed to other ride-hailing companies, which generally give drivers an 80% cut of the fare. Per city regulation, these co-op cars would all be painted one color. The taxi co-op's pick? Lime green. Has anyone painted their car yet, or are people waiting?
No, because we haven't even got the approval yet.
Passmore said he's also concerned with recent news that the city is looking to deregulate the taxi industry, meaning companies could be run more like ride-hailing services such as Uber, Lyft, and Fare. But the co-op model would remain, one that's dependent on an equal buy-in from members. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
Also this week, Texas lawmakers took some of the first steps toward considering statewide rules for ride-hailing companies. There's a panel of state lawmakers. One of the committees heard from representatives of both newer and older transportation models. Ed Cargbo, president of Yellow Cab Austin, warned against adopting more lenient rules. He said that could result in a market where service standards are just thrown out the window.
We're not interested in in seeing a situation where you're facilitating a race to the bottom. But certainly, yes, we want to compete in an environment where everybody is held to a high standard. Because at the end of the day, that drives more business for all of us.
The general manager of Uber Texas, Surfraz Maradia, encouraged state lawmakers to adopt legislation that could override some of the local rules, like the requirement in Austin for fingerprint-based background checks. That's what prompted Uber and Lyft to leave the city.
Along with a lot of people, especially out of the after the recent situation in Austin, there are more and more people calling for a statewide solution here. We would be supportive of that. But independent of that, we continue to want to work with cities to try to address these issues.
Some Republican state lawmakers, including Charles Schwertner of Georgetown, have argued along the same lines. But the Democratic chair of the House Transportation Committee says he's reluctant to undo municipal ordinances. There's a political squall in Texas right now that's shaping up into a storm across the country. It's over which bathroom transgender people should be allowed to use. A lot of the debate is over public school bathrooms. It's because the federal government issued a directive saying schools should allow transgender students to use the bathroom of the gender they identify with. Most Republican state officials in Texas have rejected that idea, saying the policy could put women at risk. KUT's Kate McGee talked to one transgender student about her experience with public school bathrooms. And a note, we've agreed only to use the student's first name for this story.
Ella just graduated eighth grade. She loves theater and clothes, and she's smart. She was on the Keeling Middle School Quiz Bowl team,
which is like a academic quiz championship, is sort of like Jeopardy.
She was also accepted into Austin ISD's best high school next year, the Liberal Arts and Science Academy. Ella was born anatomically male. Last summer, she told her family and friends she wanted to transition from male to female. She started going by Ella, what her parents would have called her if she was born anatomically female. And she started dressing in typical feminine clothing.
I feel like it's a very physical manifestation of gender. And so it's very easy to see and to use to present a certain way.
Ella says friends and family were supportive.
I was able to ease sort of into society the way I wanted to be very quickly and easily.
It's not always a perfect situation. At school, sometimes she gets more attention than she wants.
A lot of times people go out of their way to sort of talk to me and say little comments. Sometimes people will be like, oh, are you a boy or a girl? And what gender are you? And sometimes lots of people will fake ask me out sort of as a joke.
But when she started eighth grade, her school tried to be accommodating. They turned a teacher's bathroom into a gender neutral bathroom. And when Ella changed for gym,
I came up with this sort of situation with the PE coaches, where basically I used the dressing rooms in the theater, which is right across the hall from the gym.
Still, Ella says she wishes she was treated like everyone else.
Keelan has been very supportive, but I feel like it would be better if I could just use the girls' bathrooms in locker rooms. Even though I'm not having to use the boys' bathroom, it's still setting me apart, basically, which is uncomfortable.
Ella says she sometimes uses the girls' bathroom and there's been no reaction from other students or staff.
I don't think anyone actually has a problem with it. I feel like it's more of a sort of a protocol thing that they're not quite sure what to do, and so they're trying to just make as few waves as possible, I think.
But if you listen to some state leaders, the dialogue is a bit different.
I believe you're going to see an explosion in homeschools if this prevails. Parents are going to look for private schools. Parents are not going to send their 14-year-old daughters into the shower to the bathroom with 14-year-old boys. Not going to happen.
That's Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Last month, the federal government sent a letter to school districts telling them to allow transgender students to use the bathroom they prefer. The Fort Worth School District set a similar policy. Patrick has crusaded against the decision. He says the policy goes against common decency, makes people uncomfortable, and provides a loophole that allows male sex offenders to go into the women's room. Ella doesn't buy that argument.
People say that it's about wanting to keep perverts out of the bathroom or to keep people safe. The motivation is out of discrimination. I've read lots of articles that I agree with that it's basically the same situation as segregation in the 1950s where bathrooms were divided by race. It's the same thing now. It's not about the bathroom. It's about the people.
Ella says the debate hasn't made it to her school yet, but it's something she thinks about.
When I use public bathrooms, I feel it's such a crux of gender and boundaries that it can be sort of difficult to feel welcome in a place like that. I wouldn't ever say that I had anxiety about it, but I've definitely been very conscious of it.
This summer, Ella plans to start hormone therapy. She requested her gender be changed on her birth certificate. She'll go before a judge in August. If approved, she'll be able to use the girls' room without accommodations in the fall. Kate McGee, KUT News.
I think it'd be pretty cool if you could hop on a train in Austin, take it down to San Antonio, maybe have dinner, a couple drinks, and then take the train home the same night, not have to deal with the insanity on I-35. That has been the dream of a lot of people. A project called the Lone Star Rail District has been trying to make it happen, to build a commuter rail line from Georgetown, north of Austin, down to San Antonio. But after many years and millions of dollars, Lone Star Rail still has no rail. And now a regional government agency, it's called the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, or CAMPO, is talking about killing Lone Star Rail and starting from scratch. Joining us to talk about that is Caleb Pritchard with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor. Hey, Caleb.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Caleb. One important piece of background, though, I forgot to mention that people should know is that a major blow was dealt to Lone Star Rail earlier this year when the Union Pacific guys said Lone Star Rail cannot use their rail line, their freight rail line, for passenger rail. And right now, that's the only rail between Austin and San Antonio. So that was pretty serious because building a new rail line from scratch can be quite expensive. So I just wanted to mention that. But you were at this Campo board meeting this week where they were talking about it. What's going on?
We learned that Chairman Will Connolly, Campo's Transportation Policy Board Chair, wrote a letter to TxDOT basically saying and outlining his approach to the whole thing. And that's basically that he would rather just go ahead and shut down Lone Star Rail District without any rail or any existing rail to study. Potentially any alternatives that Lone Star Rail could study wouldn't fit with either Campo's long-term plans or Alamo Area Metropolitan Planning Organization's long-term plans. And if that's the case, then we shouldn't move forward, he says. And that would basically result in TxDOT pulling the plug on Lone Star Rail District, and then we're kind of left without any plan to move forward. But Connolly offered his alternative to say, well, why don't we just let Campo and AMPO work together with TxDOT and try to figure out our own little proprietary solution rather than outsource it to a rail district that, again, has no rail.
Of course, AMPO, the Alamo Metropolitan Planning Organization, the Campo of San Antonio, so to speak. Tell me, though, would this proprietary solution they're talking about, would that include rail?
It's completely all up in the air. From all indications, the rhetoric is very heavy on multimodal solutions. A lot of the officials are trying to not commit themselves to anything, but, you know, just as a matter of perhaps political protection. But it seems like rail is probably what everybody's working for and working towards. It's just, you know, you can't really commit to it if you're so early on into a brand new planning process that really hasn't even begun yet, because we still are figuring out what to do with the current planning process.
I guess the takeaway, it sounds like, Caleb, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that the ball is beginning to roll. The wheels are starting to turn toward killing Lone Star Rail.
That would not be an inaccurate statement. The thing is that all they did was discuss it. There was no action item on the agenda. Chairman Connolly said, come August, in our August meeting, I am going to make a motion to go ahead and pull the plug, or at least ask TxDOT to go ahead and pull the plug on Lone Star Rail District. It's a 20-person board, and it represents six counties, so there's a lot of different perspectives on this. And certainly the Austin contingent and the Travis County contingent, save Commissioner Gerald Doherty, were a bit more protective about keeping Lone Star Rail District alive. And that's primarily because Lone Star Rail District staff, Deputy Executive Director Joe Black, is saying that as much as he's more dedicated to the idea and the mission and not so much the actual Lone Star Rail District, he does contend that if Lone Star Rail and Campo and AMPO walk away from everything and try to go create their own system, then that forever closes the door on Union Pacific. And he seems to have hope against hope, that Union Pacific might actually come back to the table. But if you pull the plug, then that'll never happen. And the easiest solution for passenger rail service between Georgetown and San Antonio is forever lost.
And it's so early with Campo, I guess it's impossible to say, were they to go ahead and do it themselves, along with the San Antonio Metropolitan Planning Organization, AMPO, a timeline, or it's just, it's all abstract right now.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's awfully long term. But one other X factor is that despite all the meetings and the talks, we still have no idea what AMPO actually wants to do here. So Chairman Connolly is going to have to draft a letter, point blank, asking AMPO and their executives and Transportation Policy Board, point blank, do you guys want to move forward with this or not? Because inexplicably, we still have no idea. They're playing it as close to the vest as they can.
Caleb Pritchard, reporter for the Austin Monitor. Thanks for your time, Caleb.
Hey, it's my pleasure, sir.
On Monday this week, city leaders released a draft of Austin's first ever housing plan. Now, unlike broader visions for the city's future, this one focuses on how development will affect the housing supply. KUT's Saida Hassan reports.
Austin's population is projected to grow by almost 3% next year. To meet that growing need and the current demand, the plan calls for adding 75,000 housing units, with 35,000 of them being affordable. Betsy Spencer is director of the city's Neighborhood Housing and Community Development Office. Her team presented the plan on Monday to the City Council's Housing and Community Development Committee.
This is no big surprise. The cost of land in high opportunity areas is significantly higher, and that's a big contribution to why we have so few affordable units in those areas.
Before drafting the plan, the staff gathered input from residents across all 10 city council districts. A majority of people agreed that Austin's affordable housing should be distributed evenly throughout the city and located near transit and schools. The plan also recommends that a quarter of those affordable units be family-friendly, meaning they have two or more bedrooms. Erica Leek is with the Neighborhood Housing and Community Development Office. She says meeting those goals won't be easy, but it could keep the city's housing crunch from getting any worse.
We need to come together as a community to adopt a plan to really make headway on this issue.
In order to meet projected housing demand, the city would have to get creative with funding. The plan recommends building on existing programs, along with redirecting money from other places toward affordable housing. One idea is to build the housing on publicly owned land. Councilmember Ann Kitchen says the plan offers some useful strategies.
This is getting there for me. So I'll be wanting to think about, okay, so how do we figure out where? As one of our next questions.
The Neighborhood Housing and Community Development Office will hear more public comment this summer before issuing a revised plan. They're hoping to get final approval from the City Council late this year. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Somewhere in the forests of Northeast Texas, there is a tree or a group of trees where an invasive species is breeding. It's a beetle. It's called the Emerald Ash Borer, also known by its initials EAB. It's wiped out forests of ash trees since it arrived in the U.S. from Asia a few decades ago. And it has the potential to decimate trees in Texas if its population goes unchecked. But as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, there is a plan to fight the ash borer. And it sounds almost like something from a movie.
A movie about super tiny parasitic wasps. Ben Slager helps breed them at the EAB Biocontrol Rearing Facility in Michigan. One type is called the Spatius agrili.
And the way that it works is it finds an ash tree that's infested. And when it gets on that ash tree, its antennae start to go like crazy on the bark of that tree,
seeking the vibrations of ash borer larvae in the tree.
And it can feel the vibrations of it chewing. And so it gets closer and closer and closer,
eventually using its stinger to push through the bark.
And as soon as it gets through there, it lays its eggs on the larvae.
Those eggs hatch.
And they then eat their way into the larvae. And that's what kills the emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
I think that it's fodder for a horror movie someday.
But a lot of people say it's as necessary as it is creepy.
Last year, we released just over 1 million of these wasps in multiple states within the impacted area.
Paul Chaloux is the National Policy Manager for the Emerald Ash Borer Program at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He says the wasps might be the answer to saving America's ash trees. That's because they come from the same parts of Asia as the EAB, so they evolved to target it. Of course, tests have shown a few instances where the wasps lay their eggs in other native borer beetles.
But again, the attack rates, even on those relatives of EAB, are very, 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 very low. And we certainly wouldn't expect any impacts on the overall populations of those other species.
Now that four emerald ash borers have been caught in traps in Texas, Shane Harrington says the wasps will probably be released here too. But before that happens, officials need to pinpoint where in the state the ash borers are breeding. Harrington is with the Texas A&M Forest Service.
We suspect that there's an infected tree, you know, somewhere around the detection site. But we just, because of weather-related issues, we haven't been able to isolate that one tree yet.
If those killer wasps are released in Texas, Ben Slager, who you heard at the top of the story, wants people to know they do not sting people.
From our perspective, it's a very good thing. From the EAB's perspective, it's definitely a horror movie. They're the guy that got left behind.
I think I'm going to start working on a script right now.
Well, you let me in on it, and that sounds good.
Moses Bouchel, KET News.
More than 6,000 bars and restaurants across the United States are selling a certain cocktail this week and donating some or all of the profit to charity. The cocktail is the Negroni, and there are literally dozens of places across Austin who are taking part in this nationwide Negroni Week, which runs through Sunday. Joining us to talk about drinking alcohol for a good cause is Texas Monthly Drinks columnist Jessica DeBuy. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Nathan.
Start by telling me, what is a Negroni?
So it's a very popular classic cocktail that originated in Florence in the early 1900s. There was a bar in Florence called the Café Cassoni. And a barman there, a guy named Scarselli, started creating an aperitivo, which is super popular throughout all of Italy, just something to sip on and drink before you sit down to dinner. It stimulates the appetite. This particular aperitivo was called the Milano Torino. It was made with a bitter orange liqueur called Campari.
Campari.
It's bitter orange, and that flavor mixed with a sweet red vermouth from Torino made this really nice little aperitivo with a little bit of club soda to kind of make it sparkly. It became so popular, particularly among American tourists, that it became known as the Americano. Not long after that, though, there was a count in the area whose last name was Negroni. And he came in asking for an Americano, but he was like, I want it to be a little bit stronger. It needs to have a little bit more oomph. So he asked him to add gin to it, which he had just been to London and fell in love with gin. And so gin became part of this cocktail, which later people started coming in and asking for Negroni's drink. Hey, we want what Negroni had. And now we just have it simply called the Negroni.
But there are variations on this, right?
Well, yes, you can find different variations. I mean, the simple Negroni is easy as pie. It's 1 ounce Campari, has to have Campari, 1 ounce of a sweet red vermouth. So you can do Dolin or you can do Antica Carpano. It's wonderful. And then 1 ounce of gin. And I think the best way to do it has to have a gin that's got some good botanicals. So Citadel, The Botanist, but even in Texas, you can have Revolution Spirits Gin or Treaty Oak Waterloo Gin. So the bitterness, but then there's sweetness, and then the botanicals that have come through from the vermouth as well as the gin. It's surprisingly refreshing, even though it is bitter. I will say that it's an acquired taste. I mean, the first time people have tried Negronis, oftentimes they're like, I am not so sure. It's certainly strange. But the more you get a taste for it, I would say they're almost just too good to pass up.
And now this cocktail is being used to raise money for charity across the country, including here in Austin. What's Negroni Week?
Yeah, Negroni Week is something that started in 2013. And just as an idea to try to raise money for charities, it went from 100 participating bars in 2013 to about 6,000, as you mentioned. Last year, they raised $320,000. This year, they're hoping to beat that.
There's 77 places in Austin, according to the Negroni Week map I looked at.
Yes.
What are some of the places in Austin that are participating?
Italic is a great place to get a good Negroni. They even serve them on tap. Olive & June is serving a frozen Negroni, which in this heat is perfect for the patio. Canteen has a really good Negroni. And then there are a number of other places like Drinkwell, the Roosevelt Room, or Pesce. All of them have really good opportunities for you to try these variations on them. So instead of gin, a lot of times they'll put something else in them. Like there's a place in Houston called Cultivare that puts in Lambrusco, which is a very popular sparkling Italian wine that's super cheap, but super delicious and fruity. And then also you can find more of a white Negroni, actually, at South Congress Hotel. It's made with Cokie Americano. So
Cokie Americano, mm-hmm. What's that?
Like a wine-based liqueur. It's delicious. It gives a different flavor to it. And if you want something super boozy, you could have a Boulevardier, which is essentially the Campari and vermouth components, as well as either rye or bourbon whiskey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Getting serious.
Yeah. Now, that's something I'd have more in the wintertime. For sure.
What charities are benefiting from this?
All sorts. So it depends on the bar or the restaurant that's doing this, but they've chosen everything from the Sustainable Food Center of Austin to the Capital Area Food Bank, Austin Pets Alive, I believe the Austin Children's Center as well. So you'll find any number. You can go to NegroniWeek.com and find the participating restaurants, and that's where you'll be able to find which charities they're supporting.
Jessica Dupuy is a drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. You can read all of her stories at texasmonthly.com. Jessica, thanks for telling us about Negroni Week.
Thank you.
That, my friend, is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of June 2016. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Send any questions or comments to news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 at kut.org. ¶¶